Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod. What's in a name? I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
In the summer of 1926, Gladys Pearl Monroe did not know what her future held, only that it would include a daughter, born on June 1st. The 24-year-old film cutter was in a complicated situation, estranged from her husband for 10 months, and having an affair with her superior at RKO Pictures. Not only that, she was clinically depressed, financially insecure, and without family close by. Her two older children in the custody of her first husband back in Kentucky. But as records show, Monroe made a choice that day, constructing a new life for her and her daughter, beginning with little Norma Jean Mortensen's birth certificate. Norma Jean was the name of a client she liked while cleaning houses back in Kentucky, and Mortensen was the family name of her long-estranged husband, imparting a sense of legitimacy and stability. This document would set the tone for little Norma Jean's life, a complicated bouquet of aspirational, arbitrary, personal, and yet highly constructed. But nobody expected the level of complexity that would manifest when Norma Jean Mortensen transformed into Marilyn Monroe. She would be so much to so many, one of the most successful, most photographed, and most revered icons in modern history, an emblem of sexuality, a dazzling screen goddess, and a tragic figure of Hollywood legend. As we record this episode on what would have been Marilyn's 100th birthday, we remember her beyond the films and the high-profile romances. We remember the gray areas, the mystery, and the inner workings that made her so compelling. Today on Ghost Town, 100 years later, the secret life of Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe was born at Los Angeles General Hospital in Boyle Heights, Los Angeles, about a mile from where I'm recording this episode right now. She was a proud Angeleno who stayed in LA most of her life. Of course, she lived in Brentwood, walking distance from the Beverly Hills Hotel and Betty White's estate, which would be a far cry from her downtown LA roots. Quote, "When they said, 'Go home,' I said, 'I am home,'" she would later say to Life magazine in a 1962 interview. And it's really no surprise Marilyn Monroe was so loyal to her LA roots. It was one of the only constants in her life. Marilyn's story, though, really begins in Los Angeles with Marilyn's mother, Gladys Monroe. Gladys was born into a troubled family that would travel frequently, be out of money, and be subject to the whims of her father's alcoholism. To get out, Gladys married John Newton Baker, a man who owned an apartment building that Gladys's mom managed. At this point, let me emphasize this, Gladys was 14 years old. Baker was 23 and also abusive. Gladys lied on the marriage certificate saying that she was 18 years old. The two eventually had two children together, Robert and Bernice. In 1923, Gladys successfully filed for divorce and sole custody of her two children, but Baker actually kidnapped their children and took them back to his home state of Kentucky. Gladys, the mother of these children, followed, wanting to be close to her own kids. Soon Baker remarried, however, and let's be honest, Gladys was afraid of him. So, admitting defeat, she went back to California without her children, moving into a shared Silver Lake apartment with a friend named Grace McKee. McKee got Gladys a job cutting negatives for films, and together the two started a new chapter, embracing the roaring 20s, becoming flappers who love to party, flirt with men, and enjoy the heyday of Hollywood's golden era. Very cinematically, Grace even gave Gladys a makeover, turning her from a, quote, plain Jane brunette into a sassy, fashionable redhead. In all of my research, Gladys is described as beautiful, witty, engaged in life, loving and emulating film stars like Norma Talmadge and Jean Harlow. You can sense, perhaps, how a woman like Marilyn Monroe could come from a woman like Gladys Monroe. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In 1925, McKee got married, and so did Gladys, to a man named Martin Edward Mortensen, a 27-year-old meter man for the Southern California Gas Company. Gladys was initially attracted, among other things, to Mortensen's innate normcore nature. But of course, being Gladys Monroe, she quickly bored of her marriage. So what or who attracted her attention instead? An interesting man, but not in a good way. Charles Gifford was Gladys's recently separated boss, a film salesman at RKO Pictures, a self-proclaimed womanizer with what his biographers cite as a pretty bad addiction to narcotics. And yet, the two began an affair in 1925. Gladys and Mortensen, just to emphasize, had been separated for months. Gladys was actively dating other people, but she had been enamored with Gifford from the get-go. Nearly 10 months after her separation began and into dating Gifford and perhaps others, Gladys found out she was pregnant. Though Mortensen made many attempts to win Gladys back, ultimately the two divorced on August 15, 1928. Years later, and after she tried to give it a good college go with Griffith. But also after the birth of her daughter, Norma Jean. Before she was even born, Marilyn was controversial, clearly, and the question of Marilyn Monroe's paternity would definitely affect the rest of her life. Was her father boring Edward Mortensen? Or not boring, very toxic Charles Gifford? Or a famous movie star that didn't want to be named, which is what Gladys would later say in interviews when talking about the paternity of Marilyn Monroe. So despite what Gladys would say in later interviews, Marilyn Monroe was not the daughter of a famous actor. Legally, on her birth certificate, she was the daughter of Edward Mortensen, her mother's estranged husband. But a DNA comparison in 2022 between Monroe's DNA and that of Gifford's descendants would show her to actually be the biological daughter of Charles Gifford. Gifford would not want any part of Marilyn Monroe's life until, of course, she became famous, at which point he would often reach out. Marilyn, however, was over it and would later say it was too late for them to foster any type of relationship. In any case, after being a fun-loving flapper, Gladys was unprepared to be a mom. Again. She suffered postpartum depression and moved in with evangelical Christians Albert and Ida Bolander in Hawthorne, California, whom she'd connected with by way of her own mother. Gladys went back to L.A. for work, and baby Marilyn Monroe, weird to say, stayed with the Bolanders until the summer of 1933, when Gladys bought a small house in Hollywood and moved the 7-year-old Monroe in with her. Marilyn Monroe would always feel conflicted about her mother's care, or lack thereof. According to the biography The Passion and the Paradox by Lois Banner, quote, "The problem for Norma Jean was that she saw Gladys in too many negative moods and situations not to be troubled by her. She often would call her mother, quote, the woman with the red hair," which kind of tells you everything. Personally, I found Marilyn Monroe's mother to be almost as complicated as Marilyn Monroe herself, or at least as far as my research shows. During these years, these times in Hollywood where she was trying to be a mother, provide for her daughter, get in touch with her existing children, she was dealing with so much on her own, including her own mother's manic depressive psychosis and subsequent death, her own brother's disappearance and assumed death, and all of the machinations of Hollywood. These are all probably subjects for a whole other podcast, but let's just say she had a lot going on. Oddly enough, Gladys Monroe was also a hero. On October 24, 1929, a fire broke out at the Consolidated Film Industry where she worked, gutting the building and destroying millions of films. Monroe is credited with saving lives when she escorted women out of the editing studio to safety. But unfortunately, the mental illness that plagued Marilyn Monroe's lineage was prevalent and damaging. In January 1934, Gladys had a mental breakdown and was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. At that point onward, Gladys spent the rest of her life in and out of hospitals and was rarely in contact with her daughter. At this point, young adolescent Marilyn Monroe became a ward of the state. Always a shy girl, Marilyn Monroe developed a stutter and became even more withdrawn, bouncing from family to family and even being placed in a Los Angeles orphan's home. At this point, many biographers talk about allegations of molestation and sexual abuse, which is heartbreaking to think about after thinking about what this 11-year-old girl had already endured. It all kind of makes sense that Marilyn Monroe's childhood experiences led her to acting, as her childhood was all about survival. She would say in an interview, quote, "I didn't like the world around me because it was kind of grim. When I heard that this was acting, I said, that's what I want to be. Some of my foster families used to send me to the movies to get me out of the house, and there I'd sit all day and away into the night. Up in front, there with the screen so big, a little kid all alone, and I loved it." In September 1938, the 12-year-old enrolled in Emerson Junior High School, and as a teen in 1941, in Van Nuys High School. She was described as a mediocre student, someone who loved writing, was painfully shy, and participated in newspaper. Now, I saw a photo of her, her high school photo, in the Academy Museum's exhibition about Marilyn Monroe, and she looks so young, so wholesome. She really is, at this point, like such a piece of Americana in a completely different way. I will post this on our Instagram, but it's really kind of adorable. In 1942, the family she was staying with decided to relocate to West Virginia, and California child protection laws prevented Monroe from going. Faced with returning to an orphanage, the 15-year-old decided to leave high school and marry her neighbor, a factory worker named James Doherty, who was 5 years her senior. The marriage took place just after her 16th birthday on June 19, 1942. Monroe immediately found herself, quote, "dying of boredom with Doherty, but did what she had to do." Sound familiar? In April 1944, Doherty was shipped out to the Pacific. Of course, it was World War II, where he stayed for 2 years. Now, Monroe was an adult, legally, living alone, working at a munitions factory in Van Nuys. Glamorous, right? In late 1944, she met a photographer working in the U.S. Army who had been sent to the factory to shoot some morale-boosting pictures of female workers. It was a different time. Though shockingly her pictures were not used, in August 1945, Monroe signed a modeling contract with the Blue Book Modeling Agency. The agency deemed Monroe's figure more suitable for pinup than high fashion modeling and amped up her sex appeal, straightening her naturally curly brown hair and dyeing it a platinum blonde. According to Emmeline Snively, the agency's owner, Monroe quickly became one of its most ambitious and hardworking models. By early 1946, she had appeared on 33 magazine covers. From there, Monroe snagged a screen test with 20th Century Fox. And from there, she received a 6-month contract. I did not know this, but 20th Century Fox even selected Marilyn Monroe's iconic name for her. The first name, Marilyn, because she reminded executives of a Broadway star named Marilyn Miller. And in a strange full circle, they liked Marilyn Monroe's mother's maiden name. It was probably alluring, alliterative, maybe a little bit of both. In September 1946, she divorced Doherty, who had been opposed to her career this whole time, and finally became Marilyn Monroe. So much more after this break. The newly christened, at least by Hollywood standards, 20-year-old Marilyn Monroe spent her first 6 months at what was essentially movie star boot camp, learning to sing, act, dance, and be in and around production. It was, quote, "my first taste of what real acting in a real drama could be, and I was hooked," she said. Her contract was renewed in February 1947, and she was given her first film roles, bit parts in films called Dangerous Years and Scud-a-ho, Scud-a-hey. In Daniel Spotis's biography of Marilyn Monroe, he cites her saying that it was, quote, "my first taste of what real acting in a real drama could be, and I was hooked." Despite her passion for acting, her acting teachers thought she didn't quite have the future that she thought she would have. 20-year-old Marilyn was too shy, too insecure. And Fox Studios listened to the teachers, deciding not to renew her contract in 1947. At this point, she returned to modeling while also doing occasional odd jobs at film studios. In 1948, Marilyn's friend and occasional boyfriend, Fox executive Joseph P. Schenck, persuaded his friend Harry Cohen, the head executive of Columbia Pictures, to sign Monroe in March of 1948. At Columbia, Monroe's look was refined to emulate the look of Rita Hayworth's, but her time there was short, and her contract was not renewed after the requisite six-month period. Researching this with all of these six-month contracts, I had a little bit of PTSD. Having a impermanent, temporary, low-paying position that you don't know if you're going to have in the next year is a lot like how it is today. A bit depressing. Anyway, when her contract at Columbia ended, Monroe returned again to modeling, including nude modeling. She was fairly and reportedly comfortable with nudity. In fact, she famously slept in the nude, dressed only in a spritz of Chanel No. 5, her favorite perfume. Shortly after leaving Columbia, she also met and became the protege and mistress of Johnny Hyde, the vice president of the talent agency William Morris. Through Hyde, she was cast in All About Eve with top-billed actress Betty Davis. Davis later praised Monroe's performance, saying, quote, "Definitely, no question, I knew she was going to make it. She was a very ambitious girl and knew what she wanted and was very serious about it. I thought she had talent." From there, Marilyn Monroe's star rose, critically but also with modern audiences. In February 1952, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association named Monroe, quote, "the best young box office personality." Her personal life was also vibrant, with Monroe dating A-listers like Elia Kazan, Yul Brynner, and Peter Lawford. In early 1952, she began a highly publicized romance and eventual marriage to New York Yankees baseball star Joe DiMaggio, one of the most famous sports personalities of the era. And yet, despite all of this glamour, Marilyn Monroe always thought of herself as middle class, or at least wanting to connect with normal people and normal life. Marilyn's personal wardrobe consisted of very basic, no-frills outfits, since she believed anything too flashy would make her too sexy, too over-the-top. The exhibition at the Academy Museum in Los Angeles showcases a lot of her everyday outfits and the outfits that were designed for her by costumers and other fashion houses, and there is a stark difference. Her film outfits were glittery, glamorous, and very accentuating of her curves. Her at-home outfits were pant sets, baggy blouses, and denim. She'd often rewear outfits because she felt it made sense, that it was less wasteful and it made her more accessible to the public. On top of that, she was an avid reader and lover of art. Beyond that, her commitment to acting made her perceive herself as a mere student, not one of Hollywood's up-and-coming ingenues. She also had a fairly famous, but also not as well-known as I thought, health regimen that British Vogue called, quote, "predictably bizarre," including ingesting raw eggs in warm milk in the morning, 10 minutes of exercise every day right next to her bed, and would eat meat and raw carrots for dinner, followed by a hot fudge sundae. And for bedtime? Naked, of course, but not exactly glamorous. In an interview reported by British Vogue, she would say, quote, "depending on my activities, I sleep between 5 and 10 hours a night. I sleep in an extra-wide single bed, and I use only one heavy down comforter over me, summer or winter. I have never been able to wear pajamas or creepy nightgowns. They disturb my sleep." Despite her perhaps best efforts, in March of 1952, Marilyn was anything but your average woman, and she found herself in a not-so-average scandal. Marilyn Monroe found herself paying a social price for some work she had done years before, that nude modeling I talked about. Photos and rumors were circulating, and though it was again years earlier, Monroe tried to get ahead of it, revealing publicly that she had, in fact, posed for adult photos. In her public statement, she stressed that she had been very broke at the time and scared for her future. In the wake of the scandal, Monroe was featured on the cover of Life magazine as the, quote, "talk of Hollywood." Three of Monroe's films, Clash by Night, Don't Bother to Knock, and We're Not Married, were released soon after the scandal to capitalize on public interest. And Marilyn Monroe's honesty worked, along with some well-timed publicity, of course. The public actually sympathized with Monroe, and her film sales and popularity skyrocketed. Being crowned Hollywood's new sex symbol did have its price, and Monroe soon became frustrated with being typecast in comedies fueled by her vacant sex appeal. And yet, Monroe also fueled that fire, participating in sexy publicity stunts and hinting to gossip rags pieces of intimate information, including that she usually wore no underwear. While her behavior seemed like a paradox, and in some ways it was, it makes sense to me. In these contexts, photos, interviews, publicity, Marilyn Monroe was in control. She was in control of how she was perceived, in control of the information that was disseminated, in control of herself and her image and much of the information that surrounded it. Not so on her films, and the perfectionistic Monroe began to struggle on set with this fact. She became more erratic at work, with a reputation that she was late, difficult, insecure, and unprepared. She often depended on her acting coaches to feel confident and know her lines. According to biographer Donald Spoto, Monroe's problems have been attributed to a combination of perfectionism, low self-esteem, and stage fright. But it wouldn't be fair if we didn't mention the sexism that was prevalent at the time, both on and off screen. Sexism that victimized women on every rung of the ladder. Biographer Lois Banner said that Marilyn Monroe was bullied by many of her male directors. And that's not even everyone else, including the actors. While working on Some Like It Hot, much later in 1958, a technician would ask co-star Tony Curtis what it was like to kiss Marilyn Monroe. Curtis responded, quote, "It's like kissing Hitler." In subsequent years, Curtis clarified his statement as being reactive to Monroe's lateness and struggles on set, but still, what an asshole, right? Fuck you, Tony Curtis. In any case, to alleviate her anxiety and chronic insomnia, in the early 1950s, Marilyn began using barbiturates, amphetamines, and alcohol, which, of course, didn't help. And yet, in 1953, we get some of her most iconic performances, including the performance Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend from the 1953 satirical music comedy Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and 1954's The Seven-Year Itch, directed by Billy Wilder, whose publicity photos defined Marilyn Monroe's image. You know them, the white dress, the New York subway grate. The shoot attracted nearly 2,000 spectators at the time and helped make The Seven-Year Itch become one of the biggest commercial successes of 1955. The publicity stunt, of course, made Marilyn Monroe even more famous, but it also marked the end of her abusive and controlling relationship with Joe DiMaggio. After the shoot, Marilyn Monroe returned to L.A. a free and single woman at the top of her game. While the next era of her life would be characterized as tragic and tumultuous, in 1955, she would go on to do something revolutionary, not just for her, but for the film industry as a whole. On the next episode of Ghost Town, we'll talk about the last 6 years of Marilyn Monroe's life, her death, and her enduring legacy.